a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes, to everything that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this February 15th, 2012 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm joined now by Will Allison, and coming up in the second half of the show, Stacey Berlin and Gina Frangello will be here discussing their collection, Men Undressed, Women Writers, and the Male Sexual Experience. Will Allison's debut novel, When You Have Left, was selected by Barnes & Noble for the Discover Great New Writers, Borders Original Voices, and Book Sense Picks, and was named one of 2007's notable books by the San Francisco Chronicle. His short stories have appeared in magazines such as Zoetrope, All Story, Glimmer Train, and the Kenyon Review, and have been received special mention in the Pushcart Prize and Best American Short Story Anthologies. He is a contributing editor to One Story and the former executive editor of Story. His latest novel is Long Drive Home. It's published by Free Press. It's new, out in paperback, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Will, hello.
Hey, Marie.
Hey, this was great. This was a great novel. Tell me, for those who have not yet picked it up, tell me a little bit about content and where the idea originated.
Okay. When you say a little bit about content, you want me to
kind of general storyline.
Okay. Long Drive Home is the story of Glenn, a father who lives in suburban New Jersey, just outside of New York City. And one afternoon when he's driving his daughter home from school, he loses his temper and causes a car accident, and then realizes that there are no witnesses except for his daughter, who was in the back seat. And so when the police show up, he lies about what happened. And the rest of the book chronicles what happens as a result of his attempted cover-up.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me a little bit about the point of entry for you. Did this originate with character or plot or something else?
This is an impossible kind of question for me to answer, but this is the one time I've ever written anything when I know the exact seed of the story. I live in a neighborhood, and very much like the one that Glenn does in the book. In fact, the book is set in the town, South Orange, New Jersey, that I live in. And so one morning I had gone out to get the paper, and we're in a very densely populated area, but our neighborhood is quiet, tree-lined streets, lots of people walking their dogs and kids playing and that sort of thing. And so I went out to get my paper, and the car was just flying down the street, probably going 50 miles an hour, which is not unusual because our street is kind of, even though it's in a quiet neighborhood, it's a long, straight street. And when I picked up the paper, I just for a split second wish that I could throw it out in the street and, you know, scare the driver into slowing down. And then I immediately thought, well, that would be really stupid. You know, you could get somebody killed. And but then the writer in me was saying, but, you know, what if no one saw? And that, you know, the story started from there.
Yeah, I did have this observation because I was I did notice that it was written in the same town where you live, and Glenn in the book has a daughter, I think, similarly aged to your daughter.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about, you know, how much how interesting it is to sort of put yourself into a particular situation and then put yourself in extreme circumstance and see what, you know, what spins out from there. And then I was kind of wondering how long you stayed, you know, if you were kind of thinking about yourself in it and how long you kind of identified with Glenn and where, or if you let Glenn kind of go off on his own and do his own thing and be his own person.
Well, the circumstances of Glenn's life were very, very similar to mine, in terms of his family and where he lives and that sort of thing. And the fact that he works at home and I write at home. But he, you know, he is not based on me at all, really. I mean, he became Glenn at the beginning of the book, and none of the, you know, the daughter and wife are certainly not based on my wife and daughter. Mm. So it was more a matter of, you know, just asking the question, what if, and putting this particular character, this not me, in the situation and seeing what happened.
So tell me a little bit about mining some of the other characters, because it's written in a first-person point of view. But I assume that you kind of, you know, you have to make the other characters authentic, you know, empathetic.
I hope so.
Yeah, and they all really are. So I was wondering if there were any points of time where you sort of either had to think, you know, write from their point of view to kind of get into their heads, or kind of accessing, you know, you've got a great little daughter character in here and kind of getting into her head and sort of writing from the other perspectives, even though it's written in first person, getting to know these people. Yeah.
I didn't do the exercise of trying them and, you know, of writing those characters from, you know, like trying to write Liz, the wife's character, in first person to get to know her better, even though that was something that I did in my first book, In What You Have Left. But this time it was, I just did it all straight through from, process-wise, from Glenn's perspective.
Yeah. Did you write it fairly chronologically, the way it kind of came out?
Yeah, I did, and that... And that was kind of one of the things that I wanted to try to do, because my first book, you know, there are three different viewpoint characters and the chapters move around in time, and so I really wanted to try to write a sustained chronological, you know, a single narrator narrative.
Yeah.
So yeah, I started at the beginning. I mean, of course, I went back through it over and over and over, but. When I first drafted it, I started at the beginning and went straight through.
It's funny because it occurred to me as I was reading it, and it took me a while to figure this out. I don't know why, that there were no chapters. You know, I kind of got 75 pages and I'm like, wait a minute, we haven't had a chapter break yet. That's, I mean, it strikes me as unusual, but then, you know, but I don't know why. I mean, you know, it's, really doesn't matter. But was that sort of the intention? Because it gives it kind of this this breathless feeling is he's kind of on this track through his life and he kind of doesn't know, I mean, it's obvious how he got there, but he's on this very unintentional kind of track that's veering off into, you know, horrible consequences and directions. And I think the lack of chapters almost lends itself to kind of the trajectory of where his life has kind of gone off the rails and you know, there isn't sort of a break for the reader to kind of rest and say, wait a minute, what the heck has happened here? I don't know how intentional that was.
Well, I wanted the book to have a lot of kind of narrative momentum, and chapter breaks didn't, I played with them, but they didn't seem to work. And also, actually, when I initially conceived of the book, as the book is now, there are, the book is in first person, but then there are also some epistolary sections where Glenn is writing a sort of letter of confession to his daughter, Sarah. And when I originally conceived of the book, I thought that it was all going to be a letter from Glenn to his daughter. And so I tried that for a long time, and it didn't work, and I still kept trying it. It still kept not working. And I, you know, the main thing I was running into were there are things that I needed the reader to know that Glenn wouldn't really tell Sarah in a letter, either because he simply wouldn't tell her, or, you know, for reasons of shame or whatever, or they would be things that she already knew. So from a point of view, structural angle, it didn't work. And so what's left of the I still wanted to have some of that letter in there, and so there are the vestiges of that are still in the book, and then the rest I felt like I had to switch over and just go with a straight first person non-letter narration.
Yeah, I thought that was I don't want to call it a device, but I thought that was a really great way to sort of switch back and forth through time. And mm-hmm. the letters I thought worked really, really nicely.
Thank you.
Was that the biggest challenge structurally in putting the novel together, was trying to figure out how to put the letters in, or were there other challenges that sort of popped up?
Well, just figuring out that I couldn't do it all as a letter.
Yeah.
It took me a while to see that. But then beyond that, just the plotting. I mean, all the chapters of my first novel were originally conceived of as stories, and so I was never really, you know, plotting out a storyline for more than 30 or so pages. And, you know, so really having to do a novel's plot was new to me, and I really had no idea how to do it, and I still don't have any idea. But that was hard too, just figuring out how to handle the pacing and how to hook up the causal links between one event and the next event and the next, you know, for 200 plus pages.
Did you do any sort of either physical outlining or mental outlining to know which points you had to hit and then how to get him there? Or did he just kind of get off on his road and take you where he wanted you to go?
I didn't really outline it, and I didn't do the thing where I would write down, notes on scenes on index cards and arrange those. But one thing that I learned from writing that book is I'm definitely doing that next time. I just think it would have been, it would have been enormously helpful to have a visual sense of the storyline and just to be able to spread it all out and move pieces around instead of just trying to keep track of it all in my head.
Yeah, the forest from the trees in novel writing it strikes me as so daunting. I don't know how anybody ever does
I don't
this.
Either.
Yeah, most novelists say the same thing. I have no idea how it happened. It just, you know, it was like a train. It came, it hit me, I spun around a bunch of times, and then I was published. I don't know what happened. You're tuned in to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Will Allison. The book is Long Drive Home. I want to get back to the short story versus novel writing, because as I noticed that you've done a lot of short story writing, the question always occurs to me whether somebody is essentially a short story writer or essentially a novelist, and whether there's, you know, that ability to you know, cross genres is an easy one. Do you have any opinions on that?
I do feel like the short story is more of a form than the novel. I mean, I feel like there are more things that most successful short stories have in common than there are things that most successful novels have in common, which is to say the novel just seems more more wide open in some ways. Mm-hmm. And I know people who say I'm a story writer and I'm a novel writer, and I find writing stories as hard as writing novels. So not necessarily that one feeling easier would indicate that that's what kind of writer I am. But yeah, I mean, I would like to be able to move between the two, and I guess I'm kind of more interested in the novel form at this time, just because I haven't done it as much as I've done stories, and so it's a challenge, a new challenge.
I wonder, you know, since your first novel came out, and now this one, and it sounds like they were two totally different animals, by the way, you know, you knew where this story originated. It sounds like what you have left was a little bit more amorphous as to where that story came from. Was it easier to approach the second novel? Because it sounds now like as you're going into the third novel, you have, you know, you're going to do things differently again. Are there lessons learned that carry you from one to the next, or is it a whole new animal every time you sit down to the blank page?
I'm guessing it's a whole new animal. I mean, I'm at the stage, I'm just starting my third book, so I'm at that stage where I think I know what I'm going to do. And, you know, I think I have a plan, but I also know that that's going to turn out not to be true on some level, and that, I have no idea what kind of problems I'm going to run into. I have some idea, but there are lots of other ones that I haven't anticipated, I'm sure. And so.
Right. I wonder, you know, you always hear that people write to learn something about themselves, and I was wondering if this novel taught you either something about yourself as person and human being, or something about yourself as writer, kind of what the big lessons that you took away from Long Drive Home were for you.
Well, writing it made me want to be a much more careful driver.
Me too. Me too. That's the takeaway for all of us.
and it has, you know, and a much calmer driver. And I'm not sure that I am. And so it's made me aware of that as a shortcoming in myself. To be made aware of a problem about oneself, and to try to correct it, and then to be aware that you're maybe not correcting it that well.
Yeah. Yeah. It is funny. I mean, you know, I think driving is one of those times when, I mean, that really is a person's best opportunity to kill another person. You know, mm-hmm. you know, every person's everyday life. And it's amazing the risks I take every day in, you know, in terms of, like, I get way more aggressive driving than I would in any other circumstance. I mean, I think the psychology of driving is so fascinating. And, you know, this book is such a great example of it. But it's really strange how you really turn into a different sort of person behind the wheel that you really aren't if you're not behind the wheel. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's and it really happens. I mean, there's a wonderful book on this subject called Traffic by Tom Vanderbilt, and he talks about all kinds of things related to traffic. But one of them is the way that almost everyone behaves differently when they drive. And that you can't look at people out on the road and the way they drive and reliably pick out, like, who's the nice person or who's the aggressive person in out of the car life.
I love to hear I'm not alone on this. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good. my guest this morning is Will Allison. The book is Long Drive Home. I know you got your MFA, and I know you, is that right? You have an MFA, and you teach an MFA program, or you did?
I'm going to be teaching a class at Columbia in the spring, but I'm not a regular faculty member in a program right now.
Yeah. I'm always curious about MFAs. This is sort of the eternal debate in writing groups, and, you know, do I go back for it? Is it worthwhile? Having come out of one and, you know, going it back and forth and teaching in them, are there great advantages to doing that for, you know, kind of people that are, you know, middle-aged, kind of, you know, out of college and trying to figure out if it's a worthwhile exercise?
I think I felt like getting an MFA was very worthwhile, just in terms of kind of having time to write, and also being given an audience, you know, to actually have readers who are obligated to read your work, and to be in a real community of writers, even if only for a couple of years. I mean, I thought it was a very valuable experience, and sometimes you read about people complaining about MFA programs and about this, you know, the so-called workshop story, and There's this idea that MFA programs somehow homogenize the stories that come out of them. And from from my work as an editor, I found that to be not true at all. Mm. I've never picked up a story really and said, this is a workshop story, whatever that
means. Right, whatever that means. Yeah, no, that's a good observation. I do like the amount of time it gives you. I certainly like the deadline idea.
Because
I think writers, you can go on forever, right? 10 or 15 years, and if you don't have a hardcore deadline, forget it. Are you able to read to us for a couple of minutes from the book? I would love for you to do that.
I am. I'd be happy to.
Perfect.
Run upstairs. I left my book up here.
Yeah, no worries. I'm also wondering if as you're doing your work on short stories and your work on novels, did the short stories keep kind of enduring between the novels, where you keep coming back to that form, or is that kind of a form that you leave behind during your novel writing?
I haven't worked on any stories since I started Long Drive Home.
Okay.
And I'm starting another novel now, so I don't anticipate working on stories while I'm working on that.
Okay,
I'm just going to read from the right from the beginning of the book, because that will require no explanation.
Perfect.
I think it's about 2 minutes and 15 seconds. Is that good? Or I can.
That's perfect. Great. That's great.
All right. So this is one of the. The book opens with one of the epistolary sections I was talking about earlier. Dear Sarah, it's hard for me to imagine the person you'll be when you read this, probably on your way to college and a life of your own. Sometimes that feels like forever away, but other times, when you get into the car wearing your mom's perfume or shush me distractedly as you study the menu at a diner, or manage to throw a baseball that goes exactly where you want it to, I feel time racing by so fast I can hardly breathe. Not knowing where things will stand between us 10 years from now, or how this letter will change them, I need to make sure you understand, before I go any further, how grateful I am to have you in my life, how lucky I am to be your father, how sorry I am for the way things have turned out between your mom and me since the accident. I know it's been hard. I know it's been confusing. My intention here is to be honest with you about all of it, to write down for later all the things I can't very well tell an 8-year-old now. You may be wondering why I'm doing this. I won't pretend I'm not hoping you'll forgive me, but please don't think I'm asking for forgiveness or that I think I deserve it. Detective Rizzo once told me that all confessions boil down to one thing, stress. People confess, he said, to relieve the psychological and physiological effects of guilt, regret, anxiety, shame, to share the burden with someone else, to at least glimpse the possibility of redemption. It's only human nature. Remember the time you spilled orange juice on my keyboard and I didn't know why it wasn't working and you told me what you'd done even though you could have gotten away with it? You said you couldn't stop thinking about it. You said you felt so bad you had to tell me, even if you got in trouble. That's where I am. People confess when their need for relief overrides their instinct for self-preservation. I don't claim to be any different. Still, I'm not sure I'd be writing this if I didn't also believe that, on some level, you already knew the truth about the accident. You were there, after all. I have to think someday it's all going to come clear to you, and when it does, you'll know not only why I did what I did, but also that I wasn't honest with you about it. You don't deserve to be lied to. I don't want that between us, not on top of everything else. I don't want to make the same mistakes with you that I made with your mom.
That was great. That was Will Allison reading from Long Drive Home. Sadly, we're drawing down on our time, but I'm wondering if you have any last-minute words of advice or wisdom for writers.
Words of advice. One thing that I've found very helpful, I try to write every day when I'm writing, and I clock in and clock out. I keep track of my hours. And I found that it makes me treat it more like a job, like something that I have to do every day, as opposed to sitting around and waiting for the muse.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I haven't heard that for a long time. That's a great idea.
The downside is when you're finished writing a short story, you can go back and figure out, how many hours you spent on it, and after you sell it for $100, you can see that you made a quarter an hour or 50 cents an hour.
Don't do that. Will Allison, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it was great talking to you, Marie. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. That was Will Allison. The book is Long Drive Home. It is out now in paperback. It's published by Free Press. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Stacey Berlin and Gina Frangella will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Signals, the only weekly news commentary radio broadcast that features a dog named Molly. Weekly Signals with Nathan Callahan and Mike Kaspar. News with a bite. Friday mornings at 8 here on KUCI 88.9 FM. Radio that keeps on giving.
Hello, this is Claudia Shambaugh, your host of Ask a Leader, airing on Tuesday mornings from 9 until 10. Join me as we explore the worlds of leaders of all stripes, of all ages, from all realms of our society. These leaders may be voted into office, appointed, anointed, or volunteers. We'll examine them all in this show. Subjects include politics, government, religion, human rights, culture, physical and mental health, and more. We'll find leaders in places the rest of us aren't even looking.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at kuci.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We are under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined now by Stacey Bierlein and Gina Frangello. Gina is the author of two books of fiction, Slut Lullabies and My Sister's Continent. The longtime editor of the literary magazine Other Voices, she co-founded Other Voices Books in 2005 and currently serves as executive editor of the press. She's also fiction editor of the popular online literary collective The Nervous Breakdown. Her recent short fiction has appeared in Fence, Five Chapters, Fifth Wednesday, Make Magazine, ACM, and F Magazine. Her nonfiction and journalism have been published widely in venues such as the Huffington Post, the Chicago Tribune, the Nervous Breakdown, the Chicago Reader, and the Rumpus. She teaches at Columbia College in Chicago. Stacey is an author, editor, and independent publisher. Her award-winning anthology, A Stranger Among Us, Stories of Cross-Cultural Collision and Connection, is used in university classrooms across the country, and she was a guest on the show with me in connection with that book a couple of years ago. She's the founding editor of Other Voices, as well as the Morgan Street International Novel Series. She serves as editor-director at Emerald Bay Books. Her articles about writing, publishing, and the arts appear in various websites, including The Nervous Breakdown. Her short story collection, A Vacation on the Island of Ex-Boyfriends, is forthcoming from Elephant Rock Books in 2012. But our book today is Men Undressed, Women Writers and the Male Sexual Experience. It's published by Other Voices, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Ladies, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
All here. We were having massive phone troubles, so I appreciate everybody hanging with me here. So hello. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having us on. How are you?
Oh, this is great. This is great. Fun book. So Stacey, why don't you go ahead and introduce the collection and what inspired it? Tell us a little bit about the book itself and then where the idea came from for it.
Oh, sure. The collection is a great lineup of vibrant stories by writers, female writers writing in the male point of view. The idea came to us actually via our co-editors, Chris Mazza and Kat Meads. Gina and I had just only sort of calmed down from promoting A Stranger Among Us, our previous anthology. And anthologies are quite difficult for independent publishers to do. We publish story collections as well. The anthologies require just a lot of time in the selection of stories. You're working with 20 authors and 20 different personalities versus one author. So we weren't exactly sure we wanted to jump right into another anthology, but when Chris and Kat presented this idea to us, we couldn't resist. It really captured our imagination right away. Chris actually has an amazing essay at the beginning that talks about sort of her experience with male authors in the classroom and how more often than not, a female story was presented to her in her early education that had been written by a male. And so her first sort of, I think we started calling them intellectual sexual experiences. Her first intellectual sexual experiences were male writers writing as women. And it wasn't until later in her own career that she began to question the authenticity of that. So they had a proposal for a book that could be used in the classroom, and our original conversation about the book was a gender studies-oriented book with about 12 to 15 authors. And then as we got excited about it, we realized that this book had commercial potential and should actually be a much bigger book. So the result is a book with more than 20 authors, and we're really thrilled with the results.
Yeah. Now, did you go out and seek out the short stories, or were people commissioned to write these?
We did approach authors that we admired, but we had an open call for submissions. And we actually, being the eternal optimist that Gina and I are, we actually expected, you know, the mailbox to be jammed and every day would be this bombardment of manuscript. We thought, you know what, female writer wouldn't want to take this risk of writing a sexual story from a male point of view. And we were kind of confused when the manuscript started coming in slowly. And we were surprised by the calls we got from authors saying, oh, I love this idea, but I just don't write sexual stories. And, you know, I sort of leave sex to other authors. And then as a writer, I became kind of confused because I've always felt that if you really know your character, you know who they are in bed. Like, that's sort of part of the exploration. And then we had colleagues who are editors calling and saying, you know, are you sure you want to get involved in this? People write so badly about sex, you're likely to, to have to read a lot of bad stories. But that wasn't the case at all. We received, when the submissions did start coming in, we received stories that we were highly impressed with. And then, again, we did call specific writers that we admired, Allison Ament, whom we had published before, Kim Adonisio, who we had published when we edited a magazine. So it came together quite nicely, but it did take some time. It took a great deal more time than we anticipated.
Yeah. Gina, you have a great story in here called Blood. Can you tell us a little bit about, did you write that specifically for this collection and kind of tell us a little bit about it?
Oh, it's actually a very old story. I wrote that story, I think, probably in about 1997. It is about a character who appears in my first novel, My Sister's Continent. I had written an entire story cycle about these characters before I turned to the novel. And so it was old. And when Chris and Kat were originally planning this manuscript and they were going to be publishing it with Feminist Press, they had solicited the story from me because Chris knew about it, and so it ended up in our final manuscript once we ended up taking over the project from Feminist Press. But the character Michael Kelsey is someone that I spent about 10 years writing about in various incarnations. So
amazing. And did that story stay unchanged for this collection?
It is completely identical to the original published version. It appeared in American Literary Review in the late 90s.
That's great. That's great. Tell us just a kind of thumbnail sketch of it to give listeners sort of a taste of kind of the flavor of some of the stories in the collection.
Well, basically, in this story, Michael, who is a divorced father in his early, mid-40s, is taking his daughter, Rachel, on a camping trip. And he has recently had a really troubling relationship with a much younger woman named Kendra, who has recently been hospitalized for rupturing her stomach after basically having a binge. She has an eating disorder. And Kendra has a sexual abuse history that Michael has only recently learned about, and he also is a law partner with her father. And so he's known her father for years and had known her since she was a kid. And so all of this is bringing up a lot of difficult issues around his own daughter's budding sexuality and about his culpability in terms of his role in Kendra's problems, because he, you know, their relationship has been really turbulent. It's been their relationship, they have a SM kind of relationship where it seemed completely consensual, but now he's questioning it based on what he's learned about her history. And so all of that is playing into his relationship with his daughter, who's kind of on this camping trip that she doesn't really know how to negotiate, and the two of them are having a hard time interacting with one another.
Yeah. It's interesting because I was thinking about this story. I was also thinking about the now it's failing me as to who wrote it, but it was the story about the party where this guy shows up at this kind of birthing party where this woman is giving birth.
Oh, that's Chris Mazza's story.
Oh, yes, right. That's right. Yeah, and I, you know, it was funny. I was thinking about these kind of aggressive men being invited into the world of women. So in your story, I can't remember if you just mentioned this, but, you know, the daughter's having her period. And so it was this really interesting kind of, you know, inviting men into the world of women, but writing about it from the male perspective that I thought was really nicely done in a lot of these stories. It was coming through the other side of this, I'm curious about your takes on imagining the opposite gender's sexual experience. If you think it's kind of, if you think it's really possible, if you know, you've had men read this and say, yeah, that's pretty much how it goes. You know, if it's right for one sex to sort of be writing about the other sex's experience and you know, kind of what you took away from the anthology.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that Chris talks about in her introduction is that writing in general, it's so geared towards trying to pin down an individual specific character. And I think that one of the really essential things about this book is that I don't think there's any woman in the entire anthology who's attempting to speak for the entire male gender. Nobody is approaching their story or their male character saying, this is how men think about sex. You always are trying to get inside of the specifics of one person's head, and male writers have been trying to do that with regard to female characters really since the beginning of literature. And it's always just been taken for granted that to a certain extent you have to try on another person's skin. You can't only write about people who are exactly like yourself, you know, whether it's in terms of life experience or something larger like gender or race or age or, you know, anything of that nature. So basically, I think we really came at this wanting to celebrate a new tradition, which is that women had started taking that chance really much more frequently in the 80s and 90s with writers like Mary Gateskill and A.M. Holmes, who's in the book, starting to really write more about men's sexual experiences and male point of view characters in general that also had forays into the bedroom. And that was something that male writers had always done, and it wasn't to criticize that they had somehow done it inadequately or that this was fair play or turnabout. It was more that women writers were now starting to have the rights or the abilities or the confidence to do that imagining as well, and that I think that's really essential to literature, is to try to understand the experience of the other, whatever the other means.
Right, right.
It's amazing to me, too, that this book seems to have found a male audience. I think whenever I'm working on something, I sort of envision my audience as female because of statistically we know that females are more avid readers. And then obviously being female myself, I just start to think of my audience as female. But we're getting a lot of nice comments from men on this book, and I sort of pictured female reviewers as well, but it's actually been reviewed by
yes.
men, and Richard Thomas reviewed it for Bookslut. He's a Chicago-based journalist, and something that sticks out for me in his review is that he says this book should be studied from beginning to end with no story left unread by any man out there that has ever wondered what women think of us, what they think we do, and what memories from their past stay with them. So that was sort of reassuring that there's a male audience out there also.
Yeah, I think they'd be dying of curiosity to know what women think of them. I would be if I was, you know. I would.
Right.
The other interesting thing.
Well, one of the reasons we were interested in having Steve Allman write the foreword as well. He's a writer who Stacey and I have admired for years, and he is a great sexual writer, and he writes from both a male and female point of view about sex, and also a lot of nonfiction about the role of sex in literature, very lucidly, really articulately, probably more so than really anyone else I can think of in terms of that subject. But he just seems such a natural, not only because of his own prowess in that way, but also just because he was able to offer right there at the beginning of the book kind of a male perspective of, okay, here's what these women are attempting to do, and, you know, it's not just a book for women, it's a book for everyone to see about how we try to understand each other.
It's funny you bring that up, Gina, because, I was just making the observation that the only man in the book, as far as I know, is Steve Allman. And his foreword was so vulnerable. You know, mm-hmm. He struck me as so kind of, you know, honest and exposed and kind of, you know, the opposite of what I would think of the male sexual experience. He sounded very unsure of himself in a lot of ways, not as writer, but kind of as, you know, as man functioning in a sexual world.
Right.
And it felt so in contrast to some of the stories that I thought that was so interesting about how men view themselves in the bedroom versus how women view men in the bedroom.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. I mean, Steve is just, he's an incredibly honest writer, and he's definitely not afraid to put himself out there on the page or to seem vulnerable. You know, I don't know. I guess certainly the anthology has its share of aggressive men, but I think there's a lot of vulnerability, too. I think definitely there's a lot of uncertainty, and that's part of the human sexual experience, is that uncertainty and that, you know, that grappling of trying to connect and not really knowing who you are or who the other person is. And Steve really put that out there right from the beginning in his foreword. I think it really sets the tone for the book, definitely.
Ain't that the truth? Yeah. Well said. I think we're all a little bit more insecure than we let on to the other person. So when you crawl inside that person's head, I think it's so fascinating. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Writers on Writing. I am speaking with Gina Frangello and Stacey Bierlein. The book is Men Undressed, Women Writers and the Male Sexual Experience. It's funny because I heard this quote about men desire women and women desire the desire of men.
I've heard that quote too.
Yeah, I kind of wonder if it's, you know, I wonder if we all just want to be desired.
I mean, I think both things are true, both genders.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. I mean, I would disagree in a pretty primal way with that quote, but I think both things are true for both genders.
Yeah, yeah. Which stories worked exceptionally well for you? Maybe you each can answer this. And what about them sort of worked particularly well for you?
Stacey, do you want to go?
Well, it's a great question because there's such a nice diversity of stories, which is something we were really striving for, and I think we're proud, we're really quite proud of the result. I think that a story that I love to see get a lot of attention in this is Wanda Coleman's story. Many of our listeners in Orange County and Los Angeles will know Wanda Coleman as a poet, and she's a former LA Times columnist. She's really sort of a national treasure. I think they introduced her at the West Hollywood Book Fair as a living legend, and I couldn't agree more. So her story in Rita's Wire is just, you know, all the vibrant spunk that you expect in her poetry in a short story. It's the central female character is an actress, and the first line is amazing. It says he knew all of her death scenes by heart. And so the minute I read that first line, I just sort of had chills. I knew we were in for a wonderful story when we received that. Oh, excuse me. I also love Private Lives by Jonas Agee. I think that's an incredible story. It's about a male relationship, two gay men, what their relationship looks like later in life when sort of all the fun of the courtship and the early marriage has died down. I think Nude Studies of an Affair is a really sensual story. I thought that was incredibly striking. It has, again, sort of a poet's appeal to it. It's really beautifully dramatic. The author, Rosebud Benoni, works in theater, and I think there you can see that in her work. It's very theatrical in the best possible way. For sort of a fun, unexpected story, I love Evening at the Cryo Crystal Circus Hotel by Rachel Resnick. Just sort of all the sass and pizzazz we expect from Rachel Resnick. The story sort of left me with the idea that I'd just been drunk in Las Vegas. that sort of surreal, unexpected moment in your life. And we feel lucky to have The Gold Cure by Jennifer Egan. We selected this months and months before Jennifer Egan's Pulitzer Prize win. And the story, is, I think, really encapsulates sort of the magic of that book as well. So it's a nice introduction to Jennifer's work for anyone who hasn't yet come across that. I'm a longtime fan of Rapture by Susan Minot, so having an excerpt of that story seems incredibly like an incredible blessing. I could go on. I could say something wonderful about them all. There actually isn't a story I dislike, which is a pretty amazing thing. I mean, even when I pick up Best American Short Stories 2011, and these are stories by, you know, what we sort of consider the masters of short fiction, there are always two or three I don't like. So. Yeah. So it's sort of a big thing for me to say that I like them all, but I
did. Yeah, and we had four editors, so we had to haggle, you know, take to the mat a few things. But basically, that turned out to be great because really things that had a lot of dissent ultimately didn't make it in, and we ended up in a situation where the stories had a great deal of consensus behind them, and we really love all of them. But as Stacey was saying, one of the great things about this book is that you've got people like Jennifer Egan, who are, you know, some of the great writers in the country, who everyone is reading their work and who are winning awards, and then you've got people who are, you know, publishing really who don't have books out yet. Someone like Susan Solomon, who we've been getting a bit of agent attention for as a result of this story, Chicks with Two First Names. She's a local Chicago writer, very still emerging. Other writers who I wasn't familiar with, one of my favorite stories in the book is Boozan Let Me Be by Vicki Hendricks. And she is a known writer, but I wasn't familiar with her, and so it was a great discovery to find her actually in Chris and Kat's original manuscript, which was partially complete when they brought it to us. And, you know, then we've got some of our favorite writers in here. Amy Bender's got a story, Motherfucker, in here that's hilarious and good. And there's a story called And a Dead American by Elizabeth Searle. It's one of the longer stories in the book, but really just kind of blew me away when I read it. It's based on a girl who's being sort of kept as almost an indentured servant in a household. But it also has to do with a lot of like Muslim relationships in the United States, and it's just really interesting and contextualized. There are so many good pieces in here. There's an excerpt by Sherry Joseph from one of her novels called, the excerpt is called The Winter Beach. And it's an interesting story because it's probably one of the least sexually explicit stories. It was just so good and so erotic and sexy. It's about a married man who's having an affair with a younger man that predates his marriage to his wife, and it's just an incredibly sexy story with very little explicitness compared to the other pieces, but it really just, you know, blew me away when I read it. She's a great writer, and she writes a lot from the male point of view.
Yeah, sex like horror, it strikes me that, you know, in a lot of cases, as much of it as can happen off the page, that it just heightens it either heightens the fear or it heightens the eroticism. And yeah, that's well observed. Oh my gosh, we didn't have enough time. Isn't that always the way? We never have enough time.
When you're talking about sex, it's always
yeah,
the way.
Definitely. The days fly by when you're talking about sex. But what a fantastic anthology and long awaited. You know, this you're right. The men have been writing about women's sexual experience ad nauseum for centuries and centuries, and so it is about time women took this on for men. And I love that the men are paying attention to it. I think that's what better praise, right? I think that's great. Stacy and Gina, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Oh, this was great. That was Gina Frangello and Stacy Bierlein. The book, Men Undressed, Women Writers and the Male Sexual Experience. There are about 20 stories in there. It is out now by Other Voices, and it is very fun. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today, but Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Stay tuned for Sister Rue coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM. In Irvine.
Walk away from me, yeah.